Showtime. Welcome, one and all. Welcome to Knife Fight. I'm your host, Brent Holland. Get the coffee going. Get the tea going. Get a beverage of your choice going, folks. This is going to be one fantastic show tonight. Here's where we're going to go tonight, folks. Inside the real Area 51 with one of the world's leading experts on Area 51, author Tom Carey. Now, here's some of the questions we're also going to look at tonight. Are there alien bodies on ice at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base? What was the jawbone that spoke Martian? Is there really a Hangar 18 at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base? Thomas J. Carey is a former Air Force veteran, folks, who, listen to this, held a top-secret crypto clearance. He's got an MA in anthropology from California State University, and he also attended the University of Toronto in its PhD program, also in anthropology. He has been a MUFON, Mutual UFO Network, State Section Director for Southeastern Pennsylvania, a special investigator for the J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies, and was on the board of directors there. Tom has also been a consultant and interviewee on the highly acclaimed two-hour Sci-Fi Channel documentary, The Roswell Crash, Startling New Evidence. He's been on the Discovery Channel's Conspiracy Theory, the History Channel's The UFO Hunters, and his 2007 book, co-authored with Don Schmidt, Witness to Roswell, Unmasking the 60-Year Cover-Up, was the number one best-selling UFO book in the world in 2007 to 2008. How you doing, Tom? Welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Good evening, Brett. Glad to be with you.
How are things in Pennsylvania tonight?
Oh, beautiful day today. It's a beautiful evening as we speak.
As we speak, I'm sitting in Montreal in my brother's backyard underneath a tent, if you will, folks, hoping that the clouds don't rain down upon me. Taking a chance tonight, but it's such a beautiful
evening. Yeah.
And after the winter we've had, boy, I'm going to take every opportunity to take in this summer. Tom, let's start off right away, shall we? You know, we're closing in on the July 2nd anniversary of the Roswell incident. Now, what's making Roswell to this day so different from all the others, all the other crash sites and all the other sightings? Why does Roswell stand out amongst the others?
Well, Brett, Roswell is called the grandfather of all UFO cases for good reason. The short answer is that there's so much there. Most of your UFO cases involve lights in the sky or a blurry, smudgy photograph, a single witness. Those are the norms. And Roswell, and unlike abduction cases where you're talking about a single person telling a story in anecdotal testimony, Roswell is an old-fashioned nuts and bolts UFO case. We're talking about a solid spaceship. We're talking about biological beings. I want to say flesh and blood, but we're not sure they had blood, but real beings and multiple witnesses. We have over 600 to date first and secondhand witnesses to this event.
Tom, is there any hard evidence? I understand that there was a dig that you were involved with in 2013 in September.
Yes.
Did that uncover anything at all?
Yes, Brett, the dig we did last fall was unlike the one we had conducted in 2002 with the Sci-Fi Channel. The 2002 dig, we had an open checkbook supplied happily by the Sci-Fi Channel, and we had the full full-fledged archaeological dig with leaders from the University of New Mexico Department of Archaeology. We had lots of volunteers to do the digging, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, last fall, it was privately funded, so we didn't have as much money at hand, but we didn't do any hands and knees on the desert floor digging. What we did was we brought metal detectors. It was strictly a metal detector scan of the desert floor. And we did come up with some items, not to say it was part of the dashboard of the craft that crashed in 47, but we came up with some items of interest that are currently being tested. They were grayish silvery in color. And so far,
and not indigenous to the desert in any sense.
Not indigenous to the desert floor, and not readily identifiable as a. I know in 2002 we found such things as canteens, horses, steel hoofs, mm-hmm. horseshoes, bullet chambers.
Sure.
Things like that were readily identifiable. But this time they were just bits and pieces of something that were gray, very thin, not part of the desert floor, but with tremendous, tremendous strength that you wouldn't expect from such thin, small items. So that's where we're at right now. And I don't have the answer as to how they will test out as far as their elements or, the metallic elements are concerned. But the tensile strength, tremendous tensile strength, which certainly you would expect a craft from, beyond the solar system to have something like that. So, yes, we did do a dig. There are things under investigation. And we're not finished with analyzing those because we want to do due diligence. We don't want to come out and have a press conference like they have in the past with certain items. They say, here's a piece of this is certainly from the Roswell craft, and that's the last you hear of it.
It's gone off the map virtually.
Was there any markings on any of the?
No.
Nothing.
No. The okay. pieces were, I would say, maybe 2 inches by 1 inch, very small. And, when they're that small, it's sort of the needle in the haystack as to what you're going to find on it. And these didn't have any markings of any kind. In fact, they looked unremarkable, but, from what I hear from my associate, Don Schmidt, that so far it's displaying tremendous tensile strength and that it's able to withstand thousands of pounds of per square inch without bending. So
that's phenomenal.
That must be my, did you hear that? That must be my, let me shut off my email and hopefully we don't get lost here. Are you still there?
Yep, speaking with Tom. Tom Carey's our guest tonight, folks, www.nightfrightshow. He's got a new book out along with co-author Don Schmidt. The book is called Inside the Real Area 51, www.nightfrightshow.com. Just click on tonight's guest book cover. That'll take you right to a spot where you can order the book from the comfort of your own home, as I like to say, and get that tea going, get the coffee going. We've got a full 2 hours with Tom tonight. We're going to get into all kinds of aspects of Area 51, including to what I alluded to in the beginning. Are there alien bodies on ice? And we'll be getting to get that question shortly. First, I want to go back to Tom and ask him, Tom, the material that you managed to find, did that have any radiation attached to it? Was there any detectable radiation at all?
The only allusion to radiation testing was done by Jesse Marcel when they first went out to the site. He was the first military person to actually visit the site, and he did take a my goodness, I love radiation detector. What do you?
A Geiger counter.
Geiger counter. Oh my goodness.
That's okay. It's okay.
Losing it here. Geiger counter. And he did not detect any radiation, no. And that's the only allusion that we can find to something like radiation being tested for. So I would have to say, based on that, no.
Something I've always been curious about, and that is, did the craft break up above the ground, or did the craft come apart once it hit the ground? Was the point of impact the cause of the craft coming apart?
Good, very good question. And the answer is very easy. Again, the answer is provided not only by Jesse Marcel and another fellow by the name of Lewis Rickett, who were both at the crash site, but by the description from all of the witnesses who were there describing the crash scene. And it's obvious that whatever crashed, and we suspect it was a craft of unknown origin from outside of our solar system, it exploded in the air and rained down small bits of metallic debris covering a sheep pasture on Mac Brazel's ranch that ran for approximately a mile by a couple hundred feet wide in a fan shape. Small pieces. And so that suggests that one of two things happened. Either it was an internal explosion that caused it to explode, that we couldn't speculate as to what it might be, or an external force had acted upon it, most likely a lightning strike. Because at that time of year, early July 1947, well, every early July, New Mexico goes through what they call the monsoon season. Heavy thunder and lightning storms. And if you've ever seen them, you've never seen anything like it. Huge lightning strikes again and again and again. And from the witnesses that we do have, unfortunately, they're all gone now, they have described hearing a muffled explosion in between thunderclaps. That was not a clap of thunder, but something else that they said that they heard. And this would have been the ship exploding. And so we then speculate, well, what could have caused it to explode? And our best guess, based on what we know, is that it was a lightning strike. Again, that's speculation, but that's our best guess. Now, was that the entire ship? No. Inside was the inner cabin, or an escape pod of some sort. It was sort of egg-shaped. It was either the inner cabin or some sort of facility inside the craft that withstood the explosion. That remained intact and flew another 30 miles and came to rest just north of Roswell, perhaps about 32 miles north and about 5 miles west of Highway 285 north of Roswell. So it's actually in two parts. The one part is a field full of small pieces that actually rained down on the sheep pasture. And then this escape pod or inner cabin that withstood the explosion and continued on another 30 miles and came to rest just north of Roswell. Now, the bodies, as far as the bodies are concerned, there were bodies or occupants, let's call them, inside the craft. We believe there were between 5 and 7, with the magic number probably being around 5, because that's what's most described to us. 4 of them were dead, but there was one still alive. The one still alive remained alive for the next 5 years and expired in 1952. From what we understand, it was undergoing some sort of test and it expired during the test. The other 4, 2 of them were at the Brazel debris field site, maybe 2.5 miles east of the actual debris field site on a low bluff. And the rest were at the site where the rest of the ship had come to rest north of town. And that's where the one that was alive was located, walking around the desert, more than likely wondering where it was at.
Wow.
And so.
Is there any witnesses to that?
Yes. Before the military got out there, the Roswell Fire Department had received a call, and the Sheriff's Department received a call, and they got out there. And we get the story from a fireman crew chief named Dan Dwyer. We get it from his daughter, Frankie Rowe, that he had gone out there and actually arrived as far as the official Roswell people. He was the first one out there. Now, this is the site just north of town where the egg-shaped affair was had come to rest. So he gets out there, and he's immediately drawn to these occupants that are lying dead on the desert floor, probably two dead that he saw. And he's walking towards them, and he's, oh, my goodness, what do we have here? Because they don't look like humans. I mean, they have two arms and two legs. It's in a very large head. And he's looking at that when all of a sudden something catches his eye out of the corner of his eye. There's some movement. And he turns and he looks, and, oh, my goodness, here's one of them walking around. It's just, it's upright, walking on two legs. And so his family, when he got home that night, they said, well, what did it look like? What did it look like? He says, well, it was about 3.5 to 4 feet tall. And had very large head, and no eye. I'm sorry, two little nostrils, not a nose, but two little holes in the front of the head for a nostril, two in the side of the head for ears. No ear flaps, just the two little holes, and two wide set eyes. And he said, in fact, it looked like what they call in the Southwest the child of the earth. Now, the child of the earth is another name for it. It's a potato bug or a Jerusalem cricket. It's like a land scorpion. It's a large cricket, scorpion-like. But they call it the child of the earth because of the shape of its head. The shape of its head is like it's like an inverted pear. It looks like an egg shape that you hold it upside down with the narrow part, the pointed part on the bottom. And he said it looked like a child of the earth. And that's all he said about it. Well, then they said, well, did you talk to it? Did you talk to it? And he said, well, yes, we talked to one another, but we didn't talk like we're talking by moving our lips, moving our mouth. We talked to one another in our heads. And today we would call that mental telepathy.
Mm-hmm.
And, what did it say? He said, well, actually, Dan said the being was more concerned about him than he was about the being. And the being told him, he said, don't worry about me. I accept my fate. My craft has been destroyed. My comrades are no longer alive. I'm by myself, and I accept my fate that I am stranded here. And that was pretty much the conversation. The being, although it had just undergone a devastating explosion and crash with the ship destroyed, comrades dead, he is trying to calm down Dan Dwyer by saying, don't worry about me. I'll be okay. I accept my fate.
When Dan came forward with this story, was there any threats against his life from the military or government agencies?
There was threats. For all of the firemen, for all the local officials, base commander from the Roswell Army Airfield south of town came out to the firehouse because he obviously had heard that the fire truck had gotten out there and that some of the fellows had seen everything. So the commanding officer, Colonel William Blanchard, came out to the firehouse and said, okay, fellas, this is a national security item. No one is to ever speak about this again. And, of course, you know, the town of Roswell depended largely for its, economy for the air base south of town. You know, the airmen would come into town and buy things, and they depended in large degree for the servicemen for their economy.
Mm-hmm.
So they did not take the threat lightly. And Blanchard meant business. No one was to talk about it. And it was a two-page story in the local newspaper. And that was it. And threats were issued, death threats to local civilians who knew about it, who had seen something, who had heard about it, especially who had heard about the bodies, who had seen the bodies. Death threats were issued.
How did the alien that was walking around, how did that particular alien come to be captured? Any idea?
Well, it wasn't captured. I mean, it was 3.5 feet tall, about 40 pounds, walking around. It had no place to go. And it's out there on the desert floor, and the military shows up. So what's it going to do? They just took it into custody, put it into an ambulance, and took it off to the base, the base hospital. It wound up at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, or Wright Field it was called back then,
right,
for the rest of its days.
Tom, by the way, folks, we're speaking with Tom Carey. He's got a new book out with co-author Don Schmidt called Inside the Real Area 51, or if you're like me, I'm glued to my chair right now, because this is amazing stuff he's coming forward with. www.nightfrightshow.com. Just click on tonight's guest book cover. That'll take you right to a spot where you can buy the book. What are some of the smoking guns? What are some of the things that the government is still trying to deny today, but are definite smoking guns, in your opinion?
Well, the first one is the first press release that they put out was that they had recovered a flying saucer. That was the first story. RAAF, that's Roswell Army Airfield, not the Royal Air Force, but RAAF captures flying saucer in Roswell region. And the story said that they had captured it, but they didn't capture it. They just recovered it because it had crashed. And they said that the wreckage was being flown to higher headquarters for analysis. Now, the higher headquarters was Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Well, the story no sooner hit the airwaves and the newspapers than the Air Force changed its tune by saying that, well, folks, it wasn't a flying saucer that the men of the 509th had recovered. Now, mind you, the men of the 509th, this is the group that ended World War II by dropping the two atomic bombs on
That's
Japan.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And in 1947, they were the only nuclear-tipped military outfit of any country in the world. So the men of the 509th had their triggers on the nuclear, their fingers on the nuclear trigger. Well, now, do you want people with their fingers on the nuclear trigger that can't differentiate between an interplanetary craft and a rubber weather balloon?
Yeah,
I don't think so.
No. Yeah.
No. That's what the Air Force wanted everybody to believe, that they had made a mistake. It wasn't an interplanetary craft. It was a rubber weather balloon and a tinfoil radar target, which they were entirely familiar with because they launched them every day when they were doing their practice bomb runs. You know, they would send them up to check out the winds aloft. And, so they were entirely familiar with them. So how could they conclude that one of those was an interplanetary spacecraft. Well, that was the big lie. That was the suspension of disbelief. But the newspapers bought the story, and they dropped this story lock, stock, and barrel. It was, like I said, it was a 2-day story. The first day it was a spacecraft, second day it was a weather balloon, end of story. Well, that was okay for the press. They were only too happy to get rid of this story, because the mainstream media, even today, they do not like stories about UFOs. They will not cover it. And as you know, it's mostly cable television that covers UFOs.
That's
and
right. Yeah.
Mysterious things like that, Bigfoot and Shark Week and all that sort of stuff.
Right on.
So the story's dead. Well, however, there were two problems. They still had the military fellas who had been out there to clean up the site, the crash sites. They knew about it. They had seen everything. And also, there were civilians from Corona and Roswell and outlying ranchers that had been to the site before anybody and who knew about it and had seen things. So they had those two groups of people to silence as well. And they proved more problematical than the newspapers. And they had to actually issue death threats. And they brought in people from Wright Patterson,
mm-hmm.
to scare everybody that they might meet an untimely demise if they didn't shut up. And the military guys, they gathered them all in various groups and issued a threat that went something like, okay, you guys, whatever you think you saw, whatever you think you heard, you didn't. And if you want to keep talking about it or you want to learn more about it, you can learn about it in Leavenworth. Now, Leavenworth is a federal prison in Kansas. And so that was the message. And the military fellows said, well, that's it for me. And my mouth is shut. And so that's how they handled the airmen on the base. But the civilians were the toughest element because, as you know, the military does not have control over civilians except in time of war or national emergency and martial law.
That's right.
So they had to do something else. And so what they did, they first would try to cajole them by saying, well, it's a real national security item. And if you're a patriot, you will keep quiet about this. And if they suspected that the person was not really going to keep quiet, and I don't know how they determined this, but in certain cases they issued the death threats that they would not only kill them, but they would kill their children as well, which is just unconscionable when you think about it. But that's what they did back in 1947. The military was king, as you, well, you're too young to remember, but after World War II, the military was at their high tide as far as public esteem was concerned. We had just defeated the Axis powers, and everything was, the war was over. The troops had come home victorious. And so whatever they tended to say tended to be believed.
1955, Area 51. Couple of CIA guys got together, Richard Bissell was one, and said, let's make Area 51 to test under the auspices of testing the U-2 spy planes.
Yep.
When did the bodies from Roswell, when did the crash debris from Roswell get switched from Wright-Patterson, or maybe it hasn't, to over to Area 51?
Well, as near as we can determine, and this comes from other investigations, because we have concentrated mostly on Roswell and what had happened and what later happened to the Roswell wreckage and the bodies. And that's why we wrote this book, Brett, is because most of your, if not all of the Roswell books, including ours, they close when the material and the bodies are shipped to Wright Field, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio. And then, you know, that's the end of the story. Well, we said, well, let's take a look at what happened to all of that stuff after it got to Wright Field. And that's where our new book, Inside the Real Area 51, picks up, is when it gets to Wright-Patterson. Now, as near as we can determine from the researches of others, is that the material at Wright-Patterson remained there. Now we're talking about the wreckage, the physical wreckage, and the bodies, plus the live one, which only lasted 5 years. But the bodies themselves and the wreckage remained there from 1947 for another 35 years. Now, that takes you to the early 1980s. Now, Dayton, Ohio is a busy place. It's, you know, it's a city. It's well populated. And, the story had gotten out that, Wright-Patterson had a lot of secrets to divulge. And, if you talk to anybody that has lived in Dayton, almost all of them have a story about the base and some of the secrets that are there. And our sense was that they had to move things because it was becoming too hot, you know, quote unquote, too hot there to keep that stuff because it was becoming known. So the story that we are able to piece together is that the first stop off after Wright-Patterson in 35 years was Area 51, just northwest of Las Vegas, Nevada, when the old Nellis test range. Very isolated. Groom Lake is right there. Mm-hmm. Easy to see who's coming and who's going. Now, you ask someone on the street, have you ever heard of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base? And they'll say, well, no, not really. But if you ask about Area 51, they've all heard about Area 51.
Do you think that Area 51 then in this story, in this narrative, was together to deflect off of where the bodies and the materials really were being held? Kind of like, I'm trying to think, in a military operation, you'll have an explosion go off in one area to have everybody's focus looking there as opposed to looking at Wright Anderson's.
Well, no, I think the bodies and the wreckage did go there.
Okay. I know that, but I guess what I'm trying to – did they blow up Area 51 to keep people's eyes off of Wright-Patterson?
No, because if the bodies and the wreckage had left, then, people can look to their heart's content and they won't find anything. And, Area 51, as you know, Brett, was, constructed in 1955, not to house aliens, but to, develop spy planes. Most notably, the first one was the U-2. The Lockheed Dragon Lady, as they called it, the U-2, then the SR-71 Blackbird, and things like that. It only became associated with aliens in the late 1980s with a fellow by the name of Robert Lazar, who came out public and said that he was a scientist. I don't know if he was a physicist or an engineer or something like that. And that his job was to work on a flying saucer that they had nine hangars that were built into the side of a mountain. And he worked in one of them. And he presumed that in the other eight, there were also UFOs, flying saucers. But he worked on one of them. And he went public with that. And if you've ever seen him, He does physically look, wow, that guy does look smart, you know. he looks like a real whiz, and he speaks very glibly, and he just presents himself as he like he knows what he's talking about. Well, the problem was that Lazar, he gave out his partial resume that he graduated from MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, very prestigious engineering school, hard sciences, and also Cal Polytechnical Institute in San Luis Obispo, again, like MIT, for scientists in physical sciences, but he was a graduate of both. Well, someone got the idea, well, let's check this out. We're not just going to accept this at face value. Well, both schools, after checking, they could find no record of his ever being there. Well, that, you know, in a court of law, if you're caught in a fib, if you're caught in a lie, if you're caught in a something like that, that where you told what appears to be an untruth, you are toast as far as a witness is concerned. And that's where Bob Lazar remains today. He has his supporters who will say, well, they couldn't find his record because the government, he was so secret that the government went in and they expunged his record because he was just so ultra secret they had to do that. Well, I myself am not on that side of the ledger. I'm on the other side. I don't think he attended either school. And why would those institutions lie to us? So,
is there any alien spacecraft at Area 51 still?
Well, I for one do not know.
Okay.
Because the Lazar story focused attention away from Wright-Patterson. Just like you said, maybe it was inadvertent, maybe it was deliberate, I don't know. But it focused attention away from Wright-Patterson, which really never did get a lot of it, except from people who knew, to that area, Groom Lake, Area 51, S4, where Lazar worked. And that's why when people are asked about Area 51, they don't talk about the spy planes. Even when they had that, again, you're probably too young, but in May of 1960, a U-2 spy plane was shot down over the Soviet Union.
Gary
Powers.
Gary Powers, that's right. Yeah.
Yes. And even in that particular incident, which caused worldwide attention on the U-2, they never really focused at all on where the U-2 was constructed and what went on there. It was mostly just, well, there was a U-2 spy plane. Yes, we build them. And one got shot down over the Soviet Union. And they put Gary Powers on trial. And they ultimately exchanged him for Rudolf Abel, I believe, a Soviet spy, a few years later. Now, with Lazar though, the cat was out of the bag, so to speak, because ever since Lazar, Area 51 has been associated with aliens and alien spacecraft and alien wreckage, flying saucers. You remember Lazar had this, one of the plastic model companies they call it the sport model. That was the, flying disc that Lazar said he worked on. And you can go to your hobby shop and still buy one. But Area 51 has been indelibly associated with aliens, alien technology and alien, bodies, since the late 80s.
Tom, I'm thinking, you know, if anytime we find a new species, the first thing we try to do is explore it, take it apart, and try and figure it out, especially if it's found dead. We don't like to kill animals or anything like that. Have they done autopsies, I imagine many, on the alien bodies, and any idea what they have found?
Yes. The stories, I point out what we know, what my co-author and I know about Roswell. We know mostly from conducting hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of interviews, over 600 of which have a little piece of the story. Not every witness we have interviewed knows the whole story. They just know their little piece. And it's our job to put it into, like a jigsaw puzzle, put the pieces together so they fit into the most parsimonious model that fits most of the data. And that's what we've done. And as far as the autopsies are concerned, they apparently attempted a preliminary autopsy when they brought the bodies in from the desert floor to the Roswell base. They first went to the hangar. They had a big hangar there. The hangar is still there. It's still a functioning aircraft hangar, but the base is no longer a military base. It's a civilian storage facility, and Roswell's airport is on the old base. Well, they brought the bodies into the, as well as the wreckage, into the this big hangar. And the bodies remained there for, I would guess, maybe half an hour. And they were then transported to the base hospital. And at the base hospital, they attempted a preliminary autopsy. But apparently the smell was so bad, because these beings were rapidly decaying. They had been out on the desert floor for several days, and in July, it's very hot out there, and they were in starting to really decay. And the smell was so bad that they had to stop the autopsy, put them in lead-lined body bags, and then flown off to Wright-Patterson, where the official autopsies were conducted. They had an aeromedical squadron, an aeromedical facility at Wright-Patterson. And they had the equipment there, cold storage, all sorts of stuff that they could do it in much more controlled conditions to preserve the tissue.
Any idea what some of the results of that autopsy? Sure, go ahead.
Yeah. We get those results from one person. His name was Leonard Stringfield. He lived in Cincinnati, Ohio. He was a businessman. He was served in the Pacific in World War II. And, he was interested in UFOs. And he had friends, both civilian and military, at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, which was not far away from Cincinnati. And over the years, word gets around that this fellow, Len Stringfield, he's a UFO researcher. You might want to tell him your story. And he collected a whole slew of stories about crashed UFOs starting after World War II, late 40s, early 50s, somewhere in there, he started collecting these stories. And a lot of them had to do with Wright-Patterson. Now, again, you're too young to remember this, but I keep saying that. But
you're very kind.
But back in the 1950s, let me ask you, who was the chief advocate for UFOs, for interplanetary UFOs, and that the there was a government cover-up? Do you know who that person was?
Oh, I was going to say J. Allen Hynek, but no, tell us who it is. I'm sorry.
It was Donald Kehoe.
Ah, that's it.
A fellow by the name of Donald Kehoe, still my favorite writer of books on the subject. Former Marine Corps major, he was the most outspoken voice that the U.S. government was conducting a cover-up on UFOs, which he concluded were interplanetary. Now, there was one thing about Kehoe, however, that was detrimental to the cause, is that because of these so-called contactees. Do you know the contactees, what I mean by the contactees?
Yes, people who have been abducted?
Pretty much, yes.
Yeah.
Back then, they didn't call it abduction, though. The contactees were just regular folks that claimed to have space brothers that would take them in their ships and fly them around the solar system. And who was to doubt them, because they seemed so sincere? There were fellows by the name George Adamski, Howard Menger, a number of others. And they hold these conventions and spin their tails. And these were obviously crackpots, but they infested the UFO community to such a degree that it became a joke. And unfortunately, they tainted the whole field just by their crazy stories. They wrote books, which sold very well, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And the mainstream media would not only not touch them, but they would not touch the subject. We still suffer today from the effects of these contactees. And most of the abductions today, they talk about experiments being conducted on them, and you know what I mean, mm-hmm. the fertilization
yeah.
things and all that. Mm-hmm. But these contactees, it was just, oh, my space brothers, they're here to save the world from ourselves. And they talked of benevolence and just how wonderful these people were. And anyway, because of them, Donald Kehoe would not touch any story about a crashed UFOs. There were stories, but he got as far away from them as he could, because to Kehoe, those stories were too close to these contactees' stories. So the whole field of that there might have been a crashed UFO or two, certainly at Roswell in 47, remained dormant.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't until Leonard Stringfield gathered enough of these stories that he started publishing these monographs. I forget they had titles. The UFO syndrome, something, crash retrievals, he called them, crash retrievals. And a number of those stories centered on a town called Roswell. And that was really the beginning of it.
Just let me do this, Tom. I just got a little Skype text in asking who our guest is. Tom Carey, folks. I hope you're as glued to your seat as I am. I've just been letting him go because, it's like watching the Roswell movie. It's incredible stuff. And this is all his virtual research. He's written a book along with a name I'm sure most of you will recognize, and that name is Don Schmidt. And the book is called Inside the Real Area 51. And, of course, both Tom and Don have done countless amount of television in terms of History Channel programs, Discovery Channel programs. So if you're just tuning in, this is who we're speaking with, and we're talking about, of course, the real deal, the real Area 51, www.nightfrightshow.com. Just click on tonight's guest book cover. That'll take you right to a spot where you can order the book. Let's go back to Tom. Tom, now,
Leonard Stringfield.
That's right. Yeah. He was putting these little books together.
Yes, these monographs, the crash retrieval syndrome about crash saucers. And he was the first one to really collect these stories and publish them. And unfortunately, he did not name his sources. You know yourself, Brent, that if you publish a book, a nonfiction book, and make these claims but refuse to name your sources, that's not very good. It loses a lot of power. And so Stringfield did not name his sources.
And it was left to people like myself and my co-author Don Schmidt to ferret out these sources to flesh out the story. Well, he published actually 8 monographs before he passed away on crashed UFOs. And we affectionately refer to him today as the father of crashed saucers. And our hats are off to him because he broached a part of the UFO phenomenon that no one else would touch. And moving along, 1980, Stringfield published his first monograph in 1978, to put that into a context of what decade we're talking about. 2 years later, the first Roswell book was published. It's called The Roswell Incident by Charles Berlitz, who was the language fellow, you know, learned German, learned Spanish, Charles Berlitz. The thing about Berlitz was that he had just had a bestseller on the about the Bermuda Triangle. And so that's why he was included in the authorship of this book instead of Stan Friedman, who had teamed up with William Moore to do the research. So if you look at the book, you'll see the authors are Berlitz and Moore, Charles Berlitz and William Moore. And Stan Friedman is not given his due on this because they felt that they wanted a name, and that was Charles Berlitz. Anyway, when I read that book, I was blown away. And, because we're talking about a nuts and bolts craft, potentially with bodies that were spirited away by the U.S. government or the Air Force. Back then it was the Air Corps, and are hidden away somewhere. And it had everything that a good mystery novel had. And I think it's because of that it's such a popular, it's the most popular UFO case of all time because it has so much mystery to it with the potential payoff at the end of the line. The payoff is a nuts and bolts craft, bodies, cover up,
disclosure,
death threats, you name it. Roswell has it.
Tom, there's something else I've always been curious. When we travel to outer space as human beings, we put on spacesuits. Were these creatures in any type of suit, if you will, for lack of a better way of putting it?
Yes. The witness testimony is that they were wearing these grayish, silvery, tight-fitting, almost like a second skin bodysuits. Nothing on their heads, like oxygen or something. Nothing on their heads, but skin tight. What do they call that? Spandex today?
Yeah, I guess it would be spandex. Yeah, it's
silvery material. Yes, that was the testimony.
We're going to be coming up to the break in just a couple of minutes. I want to tell folks who we're speaking with. Tom Carey is our guest. We're talking about his new book with co-author Don Schmidt. The book is called Inside the Real Area 51. And I'm just amazed. I'm just glued to my seat here, folks, tonight, because, like I said, it's the real deal. Some of the questions I'm going to ask Tom when we come back, one of them is, what is meant by the term blue room? Another one is, what was the jawbone that spoke Martian? www.nightfrightshow.com. Just click on tonight's guest book cover. That'll take you right to a spot where you can order his book from the comfort of your own home. Get the coffee going. Get the tea going. Get a beverage of your choice going, folks. We still have a full hour left with Tom. And when we come back, we're going to be looking at more of this amazing research that he's put together and in his new book called Inside the Real Area 51 with co-author Don Schmidt. And is that the music I hear? No. You see, Tom, I have to tell you, the music is automated. So whenever it starts, it starts. I have absolutely no control. So every show, I try to guess when the music is going to start for the break. It will be a 6-minute break, just to let you know. And there it is. And so stick around, Tom. Don't go anywhere. You got enough time to take a quick break there.
And don't forget Hangar 18.
Right on. That's part of it, too. Talk soon. Welcome back, friends. Welcome back. I'm Brent Holland. Welcome back to Night Fright. Tonight, an incredible show, folks. Inside the Real Area 51, a new book out by Tom Carey with co-author Don Schmidt. And we're getting into some juicy stuff now. We're going to be looking at Hangar 18, of course, and this mysterious bone jaw that spoke Martian. And that's what I want to get to in just a second. But first, I want to thank a fellow by the name of Kelly Logue, who puts my website up, nightfrightshow.com, and maintains it week after week after week. And it is daunting, folks, because things change rapidly. And he's a super trooper. Kelly, I know you're up in Juneau, Alaska, and thank you so much for doing that. We've never met, folks. He just contacted me off the internet like that, volunteered. And I said, sure, I'll take you up on your offer. And he's been and he's been doing it ever since. He's just a terrific, terrific guy. Tom, are you still there?
I am still here.
Thank you, my friend. Hangar 18.
Yes.
Let's go there. Is there a real Hangar 18?
Well, that's
just urban legend.
That's the lead into that. Remember I said earlier that if you ask someone about, you ever hear about Area 51, they'll say, oh yeah, that's where the aliens are.
Yeah.
Well, if you ask the question, have you ever heard of Wright Patterson? Most people will say no, but the ones who have will say, oh, isn't that where Hangar 18 is? And that's where they have the aliens. So the ones that do know about Wright Pat, it's because of Hangar 18 and the mythology that has grown up around it. Now, Brent, if you go to Wright Patterson tomorrow.
Yes, sir.
And as many visitors do, they say, well, can you point me in the direction of Hangar 18? I want to go, I want to see where the aliens are. And the information person will say, oh my goodness, you are just so far off base. There's no Hangar 18. There never was a Hangar 18. And what is unstated it as, the unstated sentence is, you stupid dope. You know, that's what they're thinking, but they're correct. There was no Hangar 18 ever. It was Building 18. It's a play on where they know what you're asking, but they're deflecting, the word you used earlier. They're deflecting by saying, no, there was no Hangar 18. But they don't tell you it was called Building 18. And there was a Building 18. There still is a Building 18. And that is where the aliens were stored. So, Hangar 18 is an interesting story in the research for this book, for that chapter.
Yes, sir.
I recall that in 1980, now this is the same year that the Roswell Incident book came out, there was a movie that came out called Hangar 18.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember it well because I used to watch the Johnny Carson show at night. It came on very late at night. And
sure,
this one night, the guest was a fellow by the name of Robert Vaughn, an actor.
Mm-hmm.
He played the man from Uncle.
The man from Uncle, absolutely. He was also in Bullet and several other things. Yeah.
Yes. I guess you would call him a character actor. But anyway, Robert Vaughn was the star along with Darren McGavin, who played Night Stalker.
That's right.
And I think he played Mickey Spillane in the Mickey Spillane Mysteries. And so on the show comes Robert Vaughn, and Johnny Carson says, hey, Bob, what have you been doing lately? He says, oh, I just finished a movie. Oh, yeah, what's it called? He said, Hangar 18. And as soon as I heard that, I jumped up or sat up. I said, I know what he's talking about. He's talking about that hangar at Wright-Patterson.
Mm-hmm.
So In trying to trace back where this legend of Hangar 18 started, I knew it had to be before this Johnny Carson show in 1980. So I'm thinking, my goodness, where do I go for this? Because I don't remember anything in the literature. Well, being an Air Force veteran, I am signed up. I'm a subscriber to what they call Air Force Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
It's published by the Air Force Association. Comes out monthly. Well, a couple of years ago, I had forgotten, but they had done an article on UFOs in this Air Force Magazine. Of course, being an Air Force Magazine, they took the Air Force line, right?
Yeah, well,
so,
sure.
They also had a nice section in this article about Roswell. And I disagreed, of course, with everything about it. And so I'm looking at – I don't know why I picked that up and started looking at it again. But in the article, the author is talking about this fellow in Florida called – he billed himself as a professor, and he was really only a high school graduate. But he signed his books Professor Robert Spencer Carr. And in this article, the author mentions that Carr started talking about a Hangar 18 at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. I should preface this by saying we did contact the writer-director of the movie Hangar 18, where he got the name of the title for his movie. He said, well, it was a term that was being bandied about in the early 1970s, and that's where he got it. So the magazine article pointed to this Robert Spencer Carr as the source for this Hangar 18. Now, I remember this well because in 1974, I was moving from California, Sacramento, California, to the East Coast to go to the University of Toronto to continue my studies in anthropology. And I remember at the
By the way, you can I just want to interrupt. If you still want to study animals, folks, you can go to the University of Toronto, except now you can study the mayor, Rob Ford. Sorry about that. Go ahead. I had to get that in.
Yes, he's big down here, too. So.
Yeah, well, he's big everywhere.
we'll leave that one for now. I remember this story as I was getting one, driving to the airport to fly to Toronto, this story about the fellow who was talking about we got to open up Wright-Patterson. There's a hangar there, Hangar 18, where these things are. And for some reason, this made big news down here. Big news, this Robert Spencer Carr. Mm. Well, it turns out that according to his son, he was just a fabricator of tall tales. And he sort of passed away in disgrace. But the term stuck, Hangar 18 stuck. Now, where did he get Hangar 18 from? Well, he was living in Florida, and as you know, a lot of military people retire to Florida. So obviously a number of those retirees were from Dayton, Ohio, who worked at Wright-Patterson. And they had told him about the aliens, the bodies, and the wreckage in conjunction with Building 18 and a Hangar 23, which was connected to Building 18. And somehow, when it passed through Carr's brain, it came out not Building 18, but Hangar 18. Maybe Hangar 18 sounded sexier, you know, than Building 18.
That was probably it, actually.
Yeah. So that's where the nomenclature of Hangar 18 got started. This fellow in the early 1970s trying to rekindle the old crash story that Skelly, the Frank Scully, Behind the Flying Saucers, 1950 mm-hmm. book, tried to, it was actually a popular book, but the story was a phony story cooked up by a couple of con men to sell some oil equipment. And, it, and that's a long story we won't get into, but the Scully book was finally put to rest as a fabrication based on some faulty stories. Well, anyways, Carr was trying to reopen this story, and he used as his focal point this Hangar 18, and that's how it all got started. And having it put into a movie, a motion picture, in 1980 sort of codified it in the public's mind of a Hangar 18 at Wright-Patterson. So that's the story that the book goes into the really details of that story. And I feel pretty good about it because prior to that chapter, I wondered myself how all this got started because
yeah.
It certainly has gotten a lot of traction over the years. And it's because of this Robert Spencer Carr fellow. So anyway, you'll learn all about that in our book. And it's, just getting to the truth. Like Jack Webb says, the LAPD detective, just the facts, ma'am,
just the facts.
The facts.
Yeah, that's a good one. Let's go to the bone, the jawbone that spoke Martian. What the heck is that about?
Our publisher wanted to change the chapter title. We like the chapter title, The Jawbone That Spoke Martian. And, so we convinced them that that was a better chapter title. And what that is, it's a fascinating story. And I don't want to give everything away here, but, it's a story, based on a dental technician named, John Musgrove, still alive in his 80s. Living in Dayton, Ohio, that used to work at Wright-Patterson in a dental clinic. And after he retired, he started working in a local VA dental clinic. And this was before the VA had all the troubles that they're currently having. But one day, his boss comes in. He says, here, I got something in this box I want to show you. And in the box is a jawbone. Unlike any he had ever seen before. It was, the human jawbone is sort of parabolic. Looking down on the mandible, the lower jaw, is parabolic in shape. It's like a parabola, you know. Ape jawbones are U-shaped, and monkey jawbones are all different shapes, and prosimian jawbones are V-shaped. Well, this was V-shaped jawbone, but it was much larger than any prosimian. Now, prosimian is like a tarsier or a lemur or a loris. You would recognize them if you saw a picture of them.
Okay.
And but this jawbone was larger, but it was V-shaped, and it didn't have any teeth. It's not that all the teeth were knocked out. It's just that it never had any teeth. It's like a jawbone without teeth. So Musgrove said, well, what do you want me to do with this? And his boss says, well, I want you to make a plaster mold of it, plaster cast. We want you to duplicate it in plaster, plaster Paris. So he makes a mold of it. Plastic mold, and then he pours the plaster Paris and makes the jawbone replicates it. And so the next day his boss comes in, are you done that? You done that? Yeah, it's finished. It's right over here. Oh, good job. Good job. So he takes the plastic mold and crunches it up and throws it in the wastebasket. Gone in the wastebasket. So he takes the plaster reproductive cast and then the original bone and puts it in the box and out he goes. Well, the Musgrove says, well, geez, I don't know what this is. My boss told me never to talk about this, don't ever acknowledge having done this. And so I don't know what's going on here. Let me see where this guy's going. So he follows him out to the front door, and his boss meets up with two guys in Air Force Blue. And Musgrove recognized one of them as being from Wright Patterson. And the boss hands the box to the one of the officers and shakes hands and goodbye, and off they go. So Musgrove says, geez, I don't know what that was all about. Well, it was later on in the day, he says, well, I don't know what that was all about. So he, but it had to be something. So he retrieves the broken up template, the mold, and he pieces it back together again, and he repours another jawbone, another plastic jawbone.
Huh.
He says, I don't know what this is. Maybe I'll find out someday. So he puts it in a safekeeping in a bank deposit,
box. Yeah.
For years. And by this time, he, along the way, he hears about Roswell, alien bodies, et cetera, at, Wright-Patterson. And he makes friends with a local journalist called Carl Day. Carl Day has an interest in UFOs. He always has had. And we dedicate – he's one of the people that we dedicate the book to, because he was supposed to be a co-author with us, but he, as soon as we signed the paperwork, he passed away.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yes. So we dedicate the book to Carl Day and to J. Allen Hynek. And so Carl Day, he says, let me have a look at that jawbone that you've been telling me about. And Carl Day immediately makes the connection that it's from one of these aliens. You know, the most common description of the head is that it looks like an inverted pear, you know, with the bulbous part at the top,
right,
and the more pointed part at the bottom. So the pointed part matches almost perfectly with this jawbone. So Carl Day takes the jawbone. Somehow he has a speaking engagement at Wright-Patterson. He has a speaking engagement. He's known locally on the TV as a journalist, you know, a features journalist. He does different special interest reports. Mm-hmm. And on this occasion, he goes to Wright-Patterson. He's talking about something. And then he puts a picture, a slide projection up on the screen, large screen of an alien that was described by his friend Len Stringfield. And it has this pointed jaw. So he takes this plaster cast of this jawbone and holds it up to the screen, and it matches perfectly in size and shape and height to the this jawbone that he's holding in his hand. And the officers in the audience did not like this at all. They thought they were, what do you call it, bait and switch?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They thought
yeah.
it was a bait and switch job,
yeah.
And they started really giving Carl Day the business. But Carl Day, he accomplished what he had wanted to do, was to make them aware of what information he had, and that there's something going on at the base. Maybe not everybody knew about it, but a lot of them did, and he wanted them to know that he knew. And, boy, they really gave him the business, and he was never asked to speak there again, obviously. And so there's a lot more to the story, but
it's in the book.
It's in the book,
yeah.
And that's why we say it spoke Martian, because the conclusion was that it was these two Air Force fellas had done this on the QT, had brought this jawbone over on their own, is the speculation. And had the plaster cast made on their own, and they took it back after it was made, and probably returned the jawbone to its resting place without anybody realizing it. So, what's interesting is I have seen the second cast that Musgrove made.
Really? Okay.
It's now on display at the UFO Museum, the International UFO Museum in Roswell.
Wow.
And I took pictures of it this past summer, because it's a new display, and that's where it's residing as we speak.
Folks, You're going to want to get this book if you've been listening all night or if you've just joined us. We're speaking with Tom Carey, of course. The book is called Inside the Real Area 51. Co-author is Don Schmidt. Now, easy way to get all of our guest books, folks, as always, www.nightfrightshow.com. Just click on tonight's guest book cover and get the book. Now, I want to ask you, in your bio, it says that you had top secret clearance, my friend.
Yes.
Are you willing to go into that direction?
Oh, well, top secret clearance doesn't mean you're clear to see aliens. I mean, that's one thing.
Go ahead.
What I was tasked to do required a top secret clearance, and that means you haven't been arrested. I mean, what they do is they send the people around to your neighborhood to ask about you. Do you know this guy? Does he look okay? I mean, has he done anything in the neighborhood that we should be, that might reflect badly on him? And they check everything out about you. And I didn't know that. I didn't know that until later on. My folks said, there was somebody around here asking about you. And I said, oh, really? And, it was the security people. But for what I did, I was in communications, and every Air Force facility, I was in the Air Force,
mm-hmm.
every Air Force facility, back in those days, they had, they didn't have computers, they had teletype machines, and every message that went out on teletype had to be encrypted, and every message that came back had to be decrypted, and I maintained the machine that did that.
Oh, I see.
Encryption and decryption.
And a teletype machine, for our younger listeners, it's kind of like a fax, a typewriter, if you will.
The keys actually click. It's like
that's right.
It's like a typewriter without somebody typing on it. You can see the clicks, the keys going, it's like the old newsrooms.
The ticker tapes.
The ticker tapes, yes.
Yeah.
Now, what is interesting is that in my Air Force career, I was stationed at a little radar site in remote Alaska. And if you ever saw the movie The Thing from Another World,
sure,
that's my favorite all-time science fiction thriller, made in 1951. Starring James Arness as the Thing. He was a carrot man, they called him, a giant, the vegetable creature. But that movie just had everything. And the radar site that I was stationed at was remarkably similar to this site in the movie The Thing from Another World. And so what would happen was that, because in that area you get a lot of snow, and during the year, and all of the local individual buildings were interconnected by hallways,
right.
So you didn't have to go outside.
Minus 20, 30, 40, yeah.
Well, if I ever found myself late at night walking alone in one of these hallways, I would pick it up and start sprinting. Because I would think about that movie, The Thing from Another World, coming down the hallway from the other direction. And, boy, I was really spooked for that 1 year up there because of where I was stationed. So I had my own little we didn't see aliens, but I'll tell you this, though.
I was going to ask if you had any incidents because during the Cold War, right?
This was actually, 1964 and 1965.
There you go.
And do you know that when I rotated out, we go down through Elmendorf Air Force Base in Anchorage. The headlines in the newspaper, the first newspaper I saw had a headline, and it was about local UFO sightings. And it showed people looking up in the sky, UFOs hit Anchorage. And that's unbelievable, but it's true. That was the first newspaper headline I saw when I hit Anchorage, was that it was about UFOs, the UFO flap that they were having.
I'm glad I did not know that up in the, when I was up north.
That was, you know, you would have been
really spooked.
Really spooked and just running down those hallways. Was there any Cold War incidences that you can talk about that were up there?
Well, the Gulf of Tonkin occurred when I was up in remote Alaska. That was the start of the shooting.
Vietnam
war for the United States was the Gulf of Tonkin incident. But as far as anything else, no, I was near Mount McKinley, which we could see on a clear day, the tallest peak in North America, and the beautiful scenery. Beautiful scenery. And it was, if you like to hunt and fish, that was the place to go. I was not a hunter or a fisherman, but the food was good. And I was a remote for a year, and it turned out to be fortuitous for me because Alaska was considered an overseas assignment back in those days. So when I came back from Alaska, they couldn't then turn around and send me to Southeast Asia. So I wound up in California.
Bless you. It's funny you brought up the movie, because one of my questions for you, and I'm going to go into it right now because I think it's a good segue. What's happening with Magic Men? This is a film that's being based on some of your books.
This is a sad topic, Brent.
Oh, I thought it was a good topic.
It was at one time. And I'm not going to pull any punches here.
Go ahead.
But next month, it will be 4 years since it was announced as we're going to make a movie out of Witness to Roswell and Top Secret Magic, Stan Friedman's book.
Yeah.
Combined the two in the movie called Magic Men, which was about the Roswell case. That's 4 years ago next month. And the script has been written for a number of years, but it has not been, you know, the books are optioned, but it has not gone into production. And we are pretty much at this point giving up. You know, Hollywood is Hollywood. I'll just say it has not happened. And we have no prospects at the moment for it going forward. So
that's too bad, because, you know, when Stan was on my show, it must be a year ago, a little less maybe, we were talking about people that were going to play him. And I had mentioned I thought a good person to play him would be Arnold Schwarzenegger with a beard. And he laughed.
Yes. Well, the thing is, Brent, is none of us are getting any younger. And it's now 4 years. And we are, of course, disappointed. We are, of course, disappointed. But you never know. Maybe tomorrow it'll say, okay, boys, we're going forward. We just don't know. And if you know Hollywood, one day you're hot, the next day you're not.
Yes, I know. Yeah, it's true. A good friend of mine, Lamar Waldron, had one of his books optioned by Leonardo DiCaprio. It's a JFK book and was supposed to come out for the 50th. Yep. And we're still all very optimistic that that book will see the light of the day. Hopefully this year, Leonardo will be involved with it. So look forward. I'm very, very much looking forward to that. But
Leonardo is my wife's favorite actor.
Is that right? People tell me I look like him.
Oh, well, then she would like you too.
Not at all.
No, but you know, a year ago I would have still been optimistic, but as we sit here tonight, I'm not optimistic.
Let's hope it turns around.
Yeah.
Your TV miniseries.
Yes. This is another Hollywood person, and that looks like that's dead too.
Oh, man.
Yes.
Okay, so.
Again, it's one moment you're buoyed up sky high, and the next moment you're down low because it's yesterday, no tomorrow, maybe yes again. We just don't know. Apparently, it was pitched to several networks, and they said no. So
I'm very surprised to hear that, especially with the success of shows like Ancient Aliens.
Yes. This is what's amazing, Brent, is some of these shows, I just don't get it. I don't get it. Not Ancient Aliens, but some of these, you know, was it Finding Bigfoot? They never find it.
A good friend of mine says, well, maybe next week they'll find him.
Yeah, I mean, it's 2 or 3 years now. You know, they're out there making these calls out into the wind. They never find it. Ghost hunters, they never, you know, they, oh, wait, did you feel that chill? Well, how many chills can you feel but still not, you know, find a ghost? But those are actually the better shows. Some of them are just, this reality business is just, some of those are just, I just don't know how they have shows, you know?
Yeah, it's kind of mind-boggling.
Here, Roswell Brent is a mystery that's left to us from, left over from the 20th century. Technically still unsolved. We hope to have something out before the year's over that will hopefully, satisfy most reasonable people.
Inevitably, I have to ask this in every show when we do something, either a JFK show or a UFO show, some type of subject matter that requires disclosure. Are we moving closer to disclosure?
Oh, no. Not at all.
You're
talking about government disclosure?
Yeah.
It's not, it'll never happen, at least in the U.S. It will not happen in the U.S. because of a number of reasons. Number one, there has to be a public mandate for it, and people have so many problems in their own lives, the economy and things like that.
Of course.
If it's ever learned that with all that's going on, the president or anybody in his administration is looking into UFOs, that would be the end of his administration. You know, with all our problems, what are you doing looking into UFOs? That's just, just get out of here with that. Get somebody serious in there. That would be the attitude. The other thing is that the Air Force and the government, if they ever admitted, folks, well, we've been lying to you for over 60 years. How's that go over? We've been lying to you for over 60 years. So the question then is, well, what else are you lying to us about? I do not, and Don is with me on this. We just do not see any disclosure short of one of them landing on the White House lawn. And even then, the skeptics would say, oh, well, that's just a Hollywood trick. That's just a Hollywood trick. They wouldn't believe it. But no. And the other reason is that back at Roswell, to suppress that case, they had to commit civil rights violations by threatening civilians with death. And they never want to admit to that because it's unconscionable what they did back then. And they would not want to own up to that. And they don't want to own up to the fact that they've been actually lying to us about something as important as other life in the universe. For over 60 years. I just don't see it.
Just speculation on your part, Tom. Do you think there has been dialogue between the various nations trying to come up with a solution? Because certainly it can't just be Canada, the United States, Mexico.
Between nations, certainly there have been sharing of notes, yes. But as far as, okay, what are we going to do about this? I don't think there's been anything coordinated officially. There's been discussions of various cases, but I don't see any coordination of, okay, this is the plan of action that we're all going to partake in. No, I do not see that.
And why Roswell? Why did the aliens come down to Roswell that day, July 2nd?
That's a good question. We're asked that question often.
Yeah,
and the answer is, of course, we don't know, but the we do know that they did, and to try to speculate, and it's all speculation as to why they would come to New Mexico. You know, the skeptics like to say, "Well, why, Why would they fly millions of light years just to come and crash into the side of a mountain? Why would they do that? Well, we don't know, but they did. And as far as why they crashed, we speculate that it was either a lightning strike or some other malfunction internally. But if I'm from another solar system in 1947, and I'm cruising, and I notice this blue planet that appears to have water, and it's speculated by scientists that you have to have water to have life.
That's right.
On any planet. And we cruise into the area of the Earth, and oh my goodness, here's this nice blue planet. Let's go down and take a look. And I'm speculating that if they can come from another solar system, another galaxy, what have you, they are capable of doing anything. And so speculating that, okay, well, where on Earth shall we look? Well, this country, United States, that seems to be pretty well advanced as far as countries on this planet. And, our machines here are going crazy over the state of New Mexico. Why is that? Oh, my goodness. We got nuclear, we've got atomic things going on down there. We've got Los Alamos Laboratories. We got Roswell Army Airfield that has atomic bombs. We have White Sands Missile Range where they're testing rockets. This must be the place where we should check out. So that's the answer, is that all of these top secret things going on in New Mexico. And New Mexico did have the most sightings and back in 47. So that would be my speculation, because the bottom line is we don't know. But
does the president, do you feel the president knows?
There are presidents who did know, of course, starting with Harry Truman.
Sure. Eisenhower.
Dwight Eisenhower certainly knew.
You think JFK did?
That's a good, I know that Nixon knew, certainly Herbert Walker Bush knew, knows.
Huh.
Don't know about, his son, George W., but, JFK, I speculate, there's speculation about his assassination that it had to do with,
the memo we sent out of aliens.
He was going to reveal. I don't know. I'm 50-50 on JFK.
Okay.
He might have known. But the ones who didn't know, I don't, Obama doesn't know. He doesn't care, I don't think, about the Clinton was interested. Clinton was interested, and I think he does know. I don't think he was shown anything, but I think his interest has carried him to come to understand that the rumors are true. I know he has a copy of our book, Witness to Roswell.
Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. Did you sign it for him?
The way that came about was that his history teacher at George Washington University was the father of Paul Davids. Now, Paul Davids wrote the foreword to our Witness to Roswell book. So when Clinton was in New York with Hillary. Hillary was giving I guess it was a fundraiser. She was giving a talk, and when the talk was over, Paul Davids went up to Bill Clinton, introduced himself as the son of his history teacher at George Washington University. And, of course, Clinton recognized the name immediately, and he gave Clinton a copy of Witness to Roswell, because he had written the foreword. Whether he has actually read it, I don't know. But he does have a copy.
He does have a copy. That's fun. What's next for you? I mean, this Roswell case, it kind of reminds me, there's so many parallels between this and the JFK case. I keep going back and forth.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Because every now and then we'll get a new film that'll come out. Somebody has passed away that was in Dealey Plaza that day and is that filmed the assassination from a different angle. And new information keeps rising.
I will tell you this, Brent. I was not a big aficionado of the assassination. they had something on TV last fall. It was a two-hour special, and I am convinced that that's what happened. It was Lee Harvey Oswald did try. He did try to assassinate the president. Instead of firing, he never got three shots off. He only got two off. The first one hit the ground and missed, and but a fragment of it caught the president in the back of the head, just a little bit, and nicked him. And his second shot was the one that went through the just below the neck.
Right.
The third shot came from the car following the presidential vehicle from a Secret Service agent who inadvertently, accidentally discharged an AR-15 rifle when the car jerked, and it happened to hit the president in the head. I'm convinced that that's exactly what happened. They did it by ballistic tests, angles, and all that sort of stuff, and it explains the bizarre behavior of the Secret Service men after the president was hit. It explains everything, and I'm convinced that that's what happened.
Hmm. Okay. You know, in both cases, there's been a cover-up.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely.
And I'm thinking in both cases – the mainstream media just doesn't want to get involved. Do you think they're part?
They don't want to get involved. You're right.
Why is that? Why is it left up to people with radio shows like George Norrie's, Art Bell's, mine, others?
Because in the case of JFK, they love JFK. And to say that he died from an accident, which is one of the Secret Service men was heard to tell Bobby, JFK's brother, when he called. He said, he asked the Secret Service man, how's the president? And the Secret Service man said, there's been an accident. Well, and Bobby then took control of what was going to happen to the president. And I don't know how to say it. Less romantic. I don't want to say anything about it. Even that assassination is romantic. But his legacy, to say that he died from an accident, is not as noble as being assassinated, if that makes any sense.
I understand your perspective. I guess the point I was trying to make in both cases, it took quite a bit to cover up the deed, if you will. And going back to Roswell, it took quite a bit to cover up that as well.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, people had to think and map out different scenarios to try and, I'll use that word deflect again, deflect, not only, the American people, but the people of the world that nothing out of the ordinary really took place.
Yes. Without media cooperation, I'm talking about mainstream media cooperation, because the cable channels, you know, they're pretty much free to do as they wish. But the mainstream media, which carries the most credibility in the minds of most citizens,
mm-hmm.
They all, at least in my opinion, they have agendas. And in the case of JFK, they love JFK. And they wanted to keep this aura about his demise at the hands of an assassin, rather than it was just a simple accident the bullet that killed him was accidentally discharged. At least that's what this particular special, and to me, it explains most of the behavior that went on after the shots rang out.
Tom, in your opinion, in your research, has there been anything that has shocked you with your research about the Roswell case?
That's a good question. I've never been asked that question. What has shocked me is, it came as a shock at first, but now I understand it, is people who were there, we know who were there, they wouldn't out and out lie, but they would just say, well, I don't remember that. We've had I was at this base, I was that base. I don't remember being at Roswell. Well, what it was is that they were living on a government pension. You know, they were retired military or retired civil servants after they got out of the Air Force. And what they were doing is they were protecting their pensions, is what they were doing.
I see.
Rather than making history correct, they were more interested in protecting their pensions. And that came as an unwelcome surprise, let's call it, at first. But then as the time went on, I understood it, because these were elderly people, and they didn't know. They were sworn to secrecy back in 47, and they didn't know if that they spoke that they might lose their pensions, and that's what they were concerned about.
And different era back then, too. We weren't accustomed to having governments lie to us in that era.
Correct.
Completely. And there was a mutual trust. Now we are so skeptical of governments.
Yes, you don't. You just don't trust them. And what's interesting is that the New York Times is a ultra-liberal publication, but they never believe anything a military officer says or the military says at face value. You know, they have to check things out before they believe anything. Well, except in the case of Roswell, that the balloon explanation, they bought lock, stock, and barrel right up front. Oh, boy, good enough for me. Case closed. That's the only thing I know that they ever believed from a military source up front at face value. Everything else, they say, well, I don't know. We better check that out. The thing is that organizations and people who depend on their livelihood, on their credibility, the credibility factor, they do not want their names in the same paragraph, on the same page, in the same book as the word UFO, because they feel it infringes upon their credibility, which is their livelihood. We're talking about doctors, lawyers, right. Professional yeah. people, politicians, those people in the limelight. They may, on the quiet, you know, at the end of the day, you know, they settle down with a book. Might be about UFOs, but they don't want anybody to know about it, because if you're interested in UFOs or Bigfoot or Lizard Man or anything what they call paranormal, well, then there's something not normal about you. That's the way it is.
It's funny, people have been ostracized. Has that happened to you and Don? It has, over and over again.
Yes, I lost one job because of it, and another one I didn't lose, but I was sorry. I told my fellow worker, he says, "Oh, please tell me about Roswell. Tell me about Roswell." I said, "Are you sure you want to learn about this?" Or yes. Well, I told him about Roswell. Well, every time after that, do you remember the old show, Outer Limits?
Sure, of course.
The theme song, remember the theme song from Outer Limits?
No, that I can't remember.
It went, you know,
something like that.
Yes. Well, every time he saw me after that at work, he would go, was I sorry I ever told him?
He was mocking you.
I just want to bring up a couple of interesting parallels between the JFK assassination, if you will,
sure.
And also Roswell and UFOs. I had mentioned before Richard Helms. Sorry, not Richard Helms. I'm sorry. He took over for I've lost it.
You're talking about the defense minister for Canada.
No, actually, I was going to talk about the fellow who made Area 51. Bissell, Richard Bissell. He, in 1955, again, folks, he made Area 51. Well, Richard Bissell was responsible for special ops in the CIA. And part of that special ops was the Bay of Pigs. And Kennedy ended up firing him because the CIA held back a special report that they did themselves that said the Bay of Pigs would never succeed. And that's a true story. And here we have this guy that's in charge of Area 51 and also involved with the JFK trying to blackmail, in my opinion, JFK into going into Cuba. Now, the other part that was brought out to me by a friend of mine, Alan, in Washington, was Curtis LeMay and Barry Goldwater in 1964. Barry Goldwater asked Curtis LeMay about Area 51. Do you know this story, Tom?
Yes. Do you
want to tell the folks?
You're talking about the Blue Room.
There you go. Yeah. Do you want to tell the folks that story?
Yes. The Blue Room these days usually refers to the most secret location in any Air Force base or any military facility, the Blue Room. And it's usually the room where they have all the computers and the radar scopes. Well, back in the early 60s, before they had all of that stuff, the Blue Room was still considered to be the most secret location on any base. Well, Barry Goldwater, Republican senator from Arizona, former presidential candidate in 1964, lost to Lyndon Johnson in a landslide, but he was also the head of the U.S. Senate Armed Services Committee. He was also a reserve major general in the Air Force. So he wore several hats. He had the political clout, and he was also an Air Force general. His good friend was Curtis LeMay, then the chief of staff of the Air Force. And we're talking now about
SAC as well.
Yes, former commander of Strategic Air Command. He built that organization to a high state of readiness. World War II, he was known as Curtis Bomber LeMay. No, I'm sorry, Curtis Bombs Away LeMay. He firebombed Japan prior to the dropping of the atomic devices. So he was a cigar-smoking, go-get-em, results-oriented type of guy. So Goldwater, in his function of head of the Senate Armed Services Committee, was doing a tour of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in 1963. And Goldwater was a UFO buff, as we would call them today. He was interested in UFOs, was a ham radio operator. So he's over in Wright-Patterson. He says, oh, my goodness, I've heard about this. He calls up LeMay. He says, General, I've heard about this Blue Room here. I'm at Wright-Patterson. I've heard about this Blue Room, and you have some interesting things in there that I understand are from space. Might I have a look in that room? Now, you figure here's a U.S. sitting U.S. senator elected by the people, chairman of the Armed Services Committee, major general in the Air Force Reserve. What more do you want? It's a perfect storm here. And he said it was the only time, and he was friends with LeMay. And he says the only time the general, he never cussed me out before, but this time he just let loose on me. I was totally taken aback. He said, hell no, you can't go in there. I can't go in there, meaning himself. I don't believe that for a second. If LeMay couldn't get in there, I don't see how anybody could.
Yeah.
But he said, I can't get in there, you can't get in there, and if you ever ask me that again, I'll see that you're court-martialed. Well, thank God they were friends, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Goldwater says, wow. He acceded to LeMay's demand that he drop that subject forthwith, and he said he never brought it up again. Well, we wish he did, but he was too much of a gentleman. He was a gentleman, and he never did bring up the subject again. But he tried to get into that Blue Room. No doubt it was in Building 18, and that was basically the story. We have a whole chapter on that. How that came about, the Blue Room.
Inside the Real Area 51 is the name of the book. We've been talking about Area 51, folks, with Tom Carey tonight, who is the author. His co-author, of course, is Don Schmidt. Easy way to get the book And it's just started to rain, folks. Isn't that great? www.nightfrightshow.com. Click on tonight's guest book cover. And just as an added little tidbit about Curtis LeMay, to show you how much of a hawk he was, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, Ted Sorensen, JFK's speechwriter, was in the XCOM meeting, and Ted told me that his attitude, Curtis LeMay's attitude, was that we should go ahead and do a first strike against Russia because we would probably survive, more people would survive in the United States than in Russia. And that was Curtis LeMay's attitude. So
bombs away, LeMay.
Bombs away, LeMay. Don't be a stranger, my friend. The music's going to start any second.
You know, LeMay ran for vice president.
I know.
In 1968 with George Wallace, I believe.
That's right. Isn't that an amazing, what a duo that would have been.
What a duo that would have been.
But we ended up with Nixon instead, so there you go. Yeah. What's next for the two of you?
We are working on several projects. We are still finding live witnesses who were firsthand witnesses back from 1947. There's just a few of them left. We are trying to find every last one, and we are working on a project really big. We hope to have an announcement before the year's over.
Thank you so much, Tom, for being our guest tonight. I'm Brent Holland from Night Fright. We'll see you all next time. Have a nice night, everybody.